Good afternoon. Welcome to Embracing the Chase, brought to you by InfinitelyHome.com, the website for first-time and affordable home buyers. Building Fortunes Radio and Blog Talk Radio are also sponsoring us today. Embracing the Chase is a radio show presenting a unique personal improvement thought, which will make your life better and your business grow. You know, I think many times as we work or strive or educate ourselves, you ask yourself as you see someone zoom by you in the fast lane, how do people get productive so fast? And I'm going to give you the four T's, in my opinion, of what makes them get there. And then we'll discuss in detail productivity and what it is and how you can get better at it. First of all, you need to become an elite skill developer. Now, it requires focused attention and disciplined action to follow the four T's of faster skill building. They are talent, teaching, training, and time. Talent is what you're born with, and you do it naturally well. It helps to start in a direction aligned with your strengths. In other words, you are a great writer. You have a tremendous vocabulary. You have excellent penmanship. You can string words together to make sentences which are cohesive and well understood. So whether you end up being a novelist or a newspaper editor doesn't really matter, as long as you start with the strength of your talent, which is writing and words. And keep it in that vein. You aren't meant to be a welder. Teaching is what you study and who you listen to. Learn from people who came before you or who can actually observe you. Tell your boss you want to learn as fast as possible. Tell him to check your work. Come by your desk when he feels like it. Tell him that you're interested in learning. Training is how you practice and how often. Treat everything as training for something. I've told you this story before, but my parents rented a piano for us for a year because they wanted me to learn to play piano. And I didn't like doing all the exercises, the scales, all that kind of stuff. It was boring. And so I would quickly learn how to read music and play the piano with chords. And made music, not very good, but made music, which was a lot more interesting than training and practicing. Unfortunately, as I look back on it now, I wish I'd have trained and practiced, because I can only play piano up to my level of somewhat enjoyment. And I feel sorry about that. And finally, time. How you use each moment and allow them to add up. Combine the urgency required for today's effort with the patience required for skill to develop. In other words, if you use the time for training, then when that skill develops, you'll be that much further along. Productivity is all of those things wrapped up into one word. Productivity, put simply, is the name that we give our attempts to figure out the best uses of our energy, intellect, and time as we try to seize the most meaningful rewards with the least wasted effort. In other words, work harder, not smarter. Wrong. work smarter, not harder. That's what it means. How we use motivation is as important as what we define it as. Motivation is more like a skill akin to reading or writing that can be learned and honed. The trick to motivation is realizing that a prerequisite to motivation is believing that we have the authority over our actions and surroundings. To motivate ourselves, we must feel like we are in control. As you know, when we believe we are in control, we tend to work harder and we definitely push ourselves more. Today was a good example again for me of what we did. I went into a meeting with the assumption that I was in control of that meeting. The lady I met with, who is head of community development for one of the cities that I'm working with right now, was very nice, small, petite, older woman. And I found that she was well-informed and knowledgeable about what she was supposed to be doing, and we had a very good conversation. But I kept moving back to that point of control. So I learned as much as I could. I asked as many questions as I required me. I made statements, so I made sure I understood what she was saying. Kept the conversation controlled so that we could go on to the next step, which we did. I think that's what everyone has to do when they're dealing with people. One way to prove to ourselves that we are in control is by making decisions. And the first step in creating the drive to make those decisions is giving people opportunities to make the choices that provide them with a sense of autonomy and self-determination. In other words, practice making a decision, even if it's wrong. And if it's wrong, you sit down with them and tell them why. If you've made a decision and you've made it wrong, you need to determine why it was wrong and then correct it so you don't make it again. It's a useful lesson for anybody hoping to motivate themselves or others because it suggests an easy method for triggering the will to act. Find a choice, any choice, that allows you to exert control. In the morning, when I get up, I don't just reach in and grab a t-shirt and throw it on. I spend 30 seconds choosing what I want to wear, which shoes I want to put on, if I want to wear socks or not, what shorts or pants am I wearing, which shirt. Those are things I have a control over, and it puts me in the practice of making decisions. It's what I do every day. I make the decision when to shower, and it depends on when I need to go out and meet people. I make the decision what we're going to have for dinner, make the decision when I'm going to start dinner. Those are things that you practice. Those are the things that you do, because every day it just builds up your quiver of practice that you have made in making decisions. Very important. Now, motivation is triggered by making those choices that demonstrate to ourselves that we are in control. And the specific choice we make matters less than the assertion of the control. You know, people have found that people with internal focus of control tend to praise or blame. And that's either praise themselves or blame themselves for failures. They praise or blame other people, and they don't assign responsibility well because they aren't in control. There's too many outside influences for them to be comfortable. They will never make good bosses. I will tell you that the biggest mistake that most companies make is if they have a sales force and they have a successful salesman, it doesn't mean that he makes a good sales manager. He is a great salesperson and he needs to stay there. Compensate him well. Keep him there. He may make more than his boss, but his boss has more confidence in the decision-making process and more practice doing it than the person who is in control because he takes control of a sales situation. Totally different. One of the things that I've learned as we go along is if you give people the opportunity to feel a sense of control and let them practice making choices, they can learn to exert the willpower. But once people know how to make self-directed choices into a habit, motivation becomes more automatic. Moreover, to teach ourselves self-motivation more easily, we need to learn to see our choices not just as expressions of control, but also as affirmations of our guilt and goals. The choices that are most powerful in generating motivation, in other words, are decisions that do two things. They convince us we're in control, and they endow us with the actions having a larger meaning, an internal focus. That control emerges when we develop a mental habit of transforming chores into meaningful choices, or when we assert that we have authority over our lives. One of the problems that I have with people who have an extraordinary amount of faith, and I'm speaking spiritual faith at this point in time, and this is not a criticism, it's that one of the problems that I have is they put too much faith in an external force that they have no control over. They are not making the decision. They are relying on someone else to make it for them, or the perception that they are relying on someone else to make it for them. One of the things that is said in the Bible is that faith is not something that you talk about. Faith is something that you do. And so sitting here talking about letting God heal us, letting God direct our lives, He gives us guidelines. There are guidelines in the Torah, in the Bible, in every major sacred volume that direct the lives. But the choice must be yours. And I think you're cheating yourself and you're quitting on life if you rely on faith as the cop-out for your inability to make the right decision. When we start a new task or confront an unpleasant chore, we should take a moment to ask ourselves, why? Because once we start asking why, those small tasks become pieces of a larger constellation of meaningful projects, goals, and values. We start to recognize how small chores can have outsized emotional rewards because they prove to ourselves that we are making meaningful choices, that we are genuinely in control of our lives. Self-motivation flourishes when we realize that replying to an email or helping a coworker on its own might be relatively unimportant, but it is part of a bigger project that we believe in, that we want to achieve, and that we have chosen to do. Self-motivation is a choice we make because it's part of something bigger and more emotionally rewarding than the immediate task that needs doing. Self-motivation becomes easier when we see our choices as affirmations of deeper values and goals. Very important. And when I come back from this break, we're going to talk about how cognitive works and how reactive thinking and how making choices make you a better person. So I'll be back in about 45 seconds right after this word from our sponsor.
Do you want to learn more about affordable home ownership and what Ed Robinson with the National Affordable Home Ownership Coalition nonprofit has going on in the Sarasota, Bradenton, Florida area? Well, go to infinitelyhome.com and read all about it. Don't forget to go to the events page for upcoming seminars in the area, and the newsletter can be found on the Home Sweet Home page. See you on the website, which once again is www.infinitelyhome.com.
Have you got any idea, besides talent, obviously, why one team succeeds and the other fails? Why one team wins the Super Bowl and the other one doesn't? I watched the New England Patriots win last year, and I marveled at how cohesive they were as a team. Everyone worked together. Everyone had the same goal. Everyone knew what to do correctly and to the best of their ability on every play. And at the end of the day, the score reflected that. And one of the reasons why teams succeed when everyone feels like it's when everyone feels like they can speak up, and when members show they are sensitive to how one another feels. I can tell you right now that if Tom Brady's having a bad day, his center comes up, pats him on the back, and say, "Hey, Tom, what's going on? How can I help?" Or some verbiage thereof, probably not that sensitive. But the reality is that he's the guy that Tom has the most contact with every game, every snap comes from him. And they have a unique relationship. So at the end of the day, he cares if Tom's feeling good. I mean, that Tom's paycheck is as much his as it is Tom's. Because if Tom has a huge paycheck, relatively speaking, so does he. One of the things that causes things to be discombobulated at times is cognitive tunneling. Because in a cognitive tunnel, we lose our ability to direct our focus. Instead, we latch onto the easiest and most obvious stimulus, often at the cost of common sense. Cognitive tunneling can cause people to become overly focused on whatever is directly in front of their eyes and become preoccupied with immediate tasks. Reactive thinking is at the core of how we should allocate our attentions, and in many settings, it is a tremendous asset. So, what are we talking about here? Reactive thinking is how we build habits. It's why we do to-do lists and calendar alerts. Rather than needing to decide what to do next, we can take advantage of our reactive instincts and automatically proceed. Reactive thinking, in a sense, outsources the choices and controls that in other settings create motivation. The downside of reactive thinking is that habits and reactions can become so automatic they overpower our judgment. However, the good far outweighs the bad. People who are particularly good at managing their attention share certain unique characteristics. They create pictures in their minds of what they expect to see. They tell themselves stories about what's going on as it occurs. They narrate their own experiences within their heads. They are more likely to answer questions with anecdotes rather than simple responses. They say when they daydream, they're often imagining future conversations. They visualize their days with more specificity than the rest of us do. Psychologists have a phrase for this kind of habitual forecasting. It's called creating mental models. And if you're successful, you do it all the time. Years ago, and I mean years ago, I set a goal for myself when I retired as a clinical psychologist that I wanted to make a ton of money. And I had a goal. And that goal was that when I retired, I wanted to be worth $25 million. And that $25 million was my goal. And I stated that goal to people, and they would laugh. But I saw instances where during a period of a short period, year, 6 months, 8 months, I would make the kind of money that would lead to those goals. Now, I could never sustain it for a long period of time, and that's a problem that I had with learning. But the reality is that if you build a robust model, we envision the conversations we're going to have with more specificity and imagine what we are going to do later that day in greater detail. As a result, we're better at choosing where to focus and what to ignore. People who are particularly good at managing their attention are in the habit of telling themselves stories all the time. They engage in constant forecasting. They daydream about the future, and then when life clashes with their imagination, their attention gets snagged for a while. Cognitive tunneling and reactive thinking occur when our mental spotlights go from dim to bright in a split second. But if we are constantly telling ourselves stories and creating mental pictures, that beam never fully powers down. It's always jumping around inside our heads, and as a result, when it has to flare to life in the real world, we're not blinded by its glare. By developing a habit of telling ourselves stories about what's going on around us, we learn to sharpen where our attention goes. Because if you want to make yourself more sensitive to the small details in your work, cultivate a habit of imagining as specifically as possible what you expect to see and do when you get to your desk. Then you'll be prone to notice the tiny ways in which real life deviates from the narrative inside your head. How many of you do that? How many of you tell yourself stories while you're working? How many of yourself have a make-believe form of life? How many of you are living that make-believe form of life in your true real-life experiences? Because you set it up so that you follow a course, and that course is pre-laid out. When you get up in the morning, you're going to do 1 to 10. and you don't do anything else except what is mandatory for you to keep your job until you've accomplished 1 to 10. It's easier to know what's ahead if you've got that script inside your head and you're following it to some extent. You know, mental models help us by providing a scaffold. Everybody knows what a scaffold is, right? For the torrent of information that constantly surrounds us. Models help us choose where to direct our attention so we can make decisions rather than just react. To become genuinely productive, we must make control of our attention. We must build mental models, and that puts us firmly in charge. Get in the pattern of voicing yourself to anticipate what's next. Experiments have shown that people with SMART goals are more likely to seize on the easiest tasks, to become obsessed with finishing projects, and to freeze on priorities once the goal has been set. Numerous academic studies have examined that impact of stretch goals and have constantly found that forcing people to commit to ambitious, seemingly out-of-reach objectives can spark outsized jumps in innovation and productivity. For a stretch goal to inspire, it often needs to be paired with something like a SMART system. The reason why we need both stretch goals and SMART goals is that audaciousness on its own can be terrifying. It's often not clear how to start on a stretch goal. And so, for a stretch goal to become more than just an aspiration, we need a disciplined mindset to show us how to turn a far-off objective into a series of realistic short-term aims. Stretch goals can spark remarkable innovations, but only when people have a system for breaking them into concrete plans. Come up with a menu of your biggest ambitions. I want you to dream big and stretch. Describe the goals that at first glance seem impossible, such as starting a company or running a marathon. Then choose one aim and start breaking it into short-term concrete steps. Ask yourself, what realistic progress can you make in the next day, week, or month? How many miles can you realistically run tomorrow and over the next 3 weeks? What are the specific short-term steps along a path to bigger success? What timeline makes it sense? For that to-do list, for instance, if you start by putting down the stretch goal at the top of the page, underneath comes the nitty-gritty. The small tasks will tell them precisely what to do. Specific. Download a grant application. Timeline, by tomorrow. I hope this helps. Stretch yourself as far as you can reach. And we'll talk tomorrow. You have a good day.